Okay, guys, let's get started today. So today we're going to be discussing animal communication and all aspects associated with how animals signal to one another, the cues they present, and effectively all of the different aspects of the ways animals vocalize, use visual signaling, auditory signaling, and many other modalities of communication. Okay, so in terms of just getting the basics of animal communication down, in its most basic form, it's a dyadic interaction. A dyadic interaction means one that occurs between two individuals. And so in the most simple sense, it involves one individual producing a signal. And imaginatively, that individual can be referred to as a signaler. And then the signal is detected and perceived by a receiver. Yeah, okay, this makes a lot of sense. One entity produces something, the other entity hears or interprets or receives that thing. In this sort of paradigm, an animal communication event occurs when the signaling behavior of one animal influences the probability of a behavioral outcome of another without the use of force. This is a complex statement, but it needs to be because a signal can be produced and received but ignored. And so if it's produced and received but ignored, it doesn't mean it wasn't a signal. It doesn't mean the animals were not communicating, but it didn't change the behavior of the receiver. And so that's why this term probability is in here, because over many instances of this kind of interaction, it will change the probability that a behavior occurs, even though it may not be true in every single case. Is that clear why we use this term probability to describe animal communication? It's because not every type of communication will result in a behavioral change, even if the rest of the process occurs. Okay, so to understand all of the different elements of animal communication, we're going to look at this type of scene here. And this is a study system from a lab that I worked in when I was living in the United States. This is the Tungara frog system. These things here are the frogs. These are the males. And so they produce these signals in order to attract females to where they are for mating events. They do so at night, that's important. They do so in the rainforest, that's important. They do so in little puddles of water in the rainforest, that's important. And there are other animals around, that's also important. So let's look at the different elements. And these are these will be the elements we will discuss today. So first, there is the signaler in this case. So in this case, it's the frog. And there's different kind of aspects to producing a signal. There's the basic genetic predisposition to produce a signal. I don't know if you remember, in the first lecture, we discussed why songbirds sing. And much of the answer to that question is because they are songbirds, because they've got the genetic machinery to produce song and the evolutionary history to produce song. There's also the learning of the signal. In many animals, the signal is not produced perfectly the first time, so they have to learn it through a process of cultural learning or from their parents. And then there's the mechanism of signal production. So, of course, in a frog, it's this large vocal sac. Depending on the type of signal, it could be many other processes as well. So that's the signaler that we'll discuss. Then we have the environment. That's a very important aspect of animal communication and signaling, is the environment in which it takes place. And so in the case of airborne communication, that's obviously moving by compression waves through the air in terms of sound production. As you may or may not know, sound travels differently through water. So if they're producing signals in water, that could be a very different process to those produced in air. And there may be occlusions, there may be other factors in the environment that disturb or distort the sound propagation. especially if it's visual, by visual means. Then we have the receiver. So in this case, it's another frog. It's the female frog in this case. So first up, she in this case has to perceive the signal, it has to hear it, it has to interact with her auditory system, her hearing system, and then it gets passed to the brain where that animal is processing that signal. And then it enters sort of the decision-making phase where she may have, in this case she, may have different algorithms based on how the signals are processed and how that will affect the probability of a behavioral outcome in that female. Then we have a broader scale communication network. And so as is a theme throughout a lot of these lectures and these talks, guys, shush. As is a theme throughout a lot of these talks, there is the existence of a broader communication, yeah, a group level property here. Animals, although our definition was simply that it was in a dyadic interaction, that dyadic interaction occurs within a network of multiple receivers. And so in this case, this male is also competing with this other male. This female is likely hearing communication from this male and this male. And there may be multiple females, of course, in the environment, not only within this pond, but within other ponds all around the world. And this can affect, of course, the communication environment, as we're going to see. Importantly, also, animal communication does not only involve the intended recipients, but there can be these other entities in the environment, which can be referred to as eavesdroppers or unintended receivers. And here, this bat is listening for these sounds produced by the males in order to locate that male and eat him. Yeah? And obviously, this is not a good thing for this male, so that can attenuate or change the way the signaling occurs. Okay. And so within this sort of broader context of all of these different aspects to this signaling environment and this animal communication process, we want to ask the question, how does this all evolve, of course, because as we always talk about, animal behavior is inherently a function of evolution and is situated within the context of evolutionary biology. And what are the fitness benefits? Okay, so all animal communication goes through the same basic process as here laid out in this book, Animal Communication. So first, it starts with the sender, and you'll notice it's a relatively mirrored process. So the sender generates the signal. In humans, you could understand that right now, I am generating a signal to you. By pushing air through my vocal cords, yeah, you are hearing that, which comes later. So I generate the sound in my case through pushing air. Then my vocal cords modify that sound so that there's different words, different meaning to what I'm saying to you. That's done by my vocal cords, of course, also by my tongue and mouth. Then there's the coupling. This means it's coupled to the environment or the medium through which it is propagated. So in this case, it is being propagated through the air that's coming out of my vocal cords and then traveling to you through a process of propagation. That is then coupled with the auditory system, in your case, in the case of speech, which is the vibrational membranes in your ears. That may need to be modified into a format that you can use. So maybe it's sort of downsampled, or these large-scale vibrations are transmitted to small-scale vibrations within your ear. And then it enters your classification system, in this case your brain. That's not always the case. It doesn't always need to go through the brain. But in this case it is. And then you classify and interpret and understand the signal. Yeah? And then maybe you change your behavior based on that signal. So this is the basic framework of animal communication. Okay, so let's discuss how signals are produced and what kind of signals there are. Okay, and so here we have a cat. And just as a basic question, what is this cat doing? Any ideas about what this cat is feeling or what its intended communication is in this case? Hands up. Otherwise, I'll just pick someone. Yeah, at the back.
Well, the cat looks frightened and makes it puts its back up so to appear bigger. It probably is like a hissing sound.
Yep.
A cat, and then also the tail is more pushing.
Okay. Good. Yeah. And it's showing its teeth.
Yeah.
Okay, so this animal is potentially afraid, or it's feeling threatened, or it's attempting to threaten another individual. And so in this case, we discussed both the visual signals of the body and also the sound that it's producing. Okay, so here is a great example. I'm sure you've all seen this little guy. He became very famous on the internet about 5 years ago. In fact, around the time when I was working in the lab that discovered this species. Unfortunately, I did not discover this species, or I'd be very famous right now, probably. So this is the peacock jumping spider. It's an Australian species. It's about the size of your fingernail, or even smaller. And it has incredible visual displays that involve, of course, the color on the abdomen, but also these dancing behaviors, where it's got this darkened patch here, on its legs that it uses to communicate to the female. Okay, and as another question, in this case, what do we assume about this spider's visual system? Any ideas? What does this kind of display tell you about the spider's visual system? Yep.
They can see colors.
Yep, they can see color. Yep. What else can they see? Yep.
They react to movement.
They can detect movement. Yep. UV light, yep, they can potentially see UV light, although in this case we're not seeing any information about the UV. Oops. Let's just watch it again. Okay, and given that the animal is distant, they also have a visual range that at least operates over this span. Yeah, and so this is a sort of important class of visual communication, which we're going to get more into next lecture, which is courtship and mate choice, which is a very strong selection force on producing ornamentation. But here we have, of course, one clear visual communication style. Okay, now I'm going to give you this one. Then the next one is seismic. Okay, so this is obviously another type of spider, another jumping spider. This is work done in the lab of a friend of mine, Damien Elias. And what you're hearing, of course, is the sound that the spider is producing as a courtship signal to the female. This is a dead female, unfortunately. He doesn't know that, and she's stuck down onto the paper. In my lab, we attempt not to kill any animals. We try to... Well, they kill each other, of course, but... we don't do it for them, but this is Damien. What you're seeing is is that the male is very cautious in his approach, right? With this visual, obviously there's a visual element, but it's also highly auditory. And we say the word seismic here. Now, seismic refers to vibrational signaling across a medium, which that medium could be air, but in this case, it's not. And so if you were to look at this spider doing this normally, just on the desk or something, you wouldn't hear anything now because it's not being transmitted through air. It's only because we have contact microphones on this paper sheet here that you're able to hear that sound. The female herself has the machinery in her legs to detect those vibrations. So in that sense, she's also hearing it, although not in the same way that we understand hearing things. And that's an important aspect of that coupling that we talked about. Yeah, it has to be the correct kind of communication for the medium through which it's traveling. This type of spider will often choose leaves or other surfaces that will best transmit that kind of communication rather than just doing it on a stone, right? Because it wouldn't work. The female wouldn't hear it at all. Okay, then we have another aspect of signaling. This is olfactory communication, which you're about to see here demonstrated. So this male lion is smelling for the presence of other olfactory signals and then depositing its own olfactory signal. And of course, this is a very common process in dogs. As you take them for a walk, their whole environment or their whole sort of communication world is much more focused on smell and long-lasting smells, and in this case through urine-borne signals of testosterone or some other hormones or of identity. And so olfactory signaling is also a massively important aspect of signaling that is not very prevalent for humans. We smell stuff, but we smell stuff very, very poorly compared to many other animals in the world. And then we have auditory signals. So this is the Tungara frog. The reason it's called the Tungara frog is because supposedly that sound goes Tungara, but I think that's a bit silly. But this is the frog that I worked with in the Panamanian rainforest. And you'll go into the rainforest on any given night and there'll be thousands of these animals making this sound, which sounds a bit like a video game in this sort of signal that they're producing. But this is also that frog that we talked about in the first slides was the sort of reference point here. And so obviously this is also a sort of thinking about visual and auditory communication. Those are the two kinds of communication that humans most often think about when they think about animal behavior, because they're our two primary modes of communication, not always true for other animals. Now, an important aspect of all of these things, and especially when we're thinking about humans and the way we interpret animal behavior and animal communication, is the sensory range. So everyone knows that whales make incredibly deep sounds, right? So they communicate over vast distances over the ocean with infrasound. Infrasound meaning below our own range. But of course, there's also all kinds of electromagnetic information that humans are not well equipped to detect. I would have said C, but of course we detect some of these wavelengths, up here, by other processes, like we feel heat in the far end of this spectrum. But many animals have sensory ranges that exist outside of those bounds. And so here we have our peak sensitivity on the electromagnetic spectrum. Bees have another peak in the short wavelength. So just like you said with the ultraviolet, many animals are sensitive to ultraviolet light, and there can be information encoded on other animals or plants or these things that also give information about the ultraviolet, about that organism in the ultraviolet spectrum. And so here's a good example of this flower that actually has more information in the ultraviolet that humans are simply not able to see. For all, basically all of our sensory modalities, or all of our sensory modalities, there's information outside that we are not able to see. So humans are a pretty poor example of sensory systems for most things. Our visual system is okay, but our tactile sensitivity, our auditory sensitivity, certainly our olfactory sensitivity are relatively poor compared to other animals. Okay, and so then we come to the question about the proximate reasons for behavior. What are animals talking about and why? Why are they attempting to communicate these things through these different modalities? And we'll just run through a few examples of the ways animals communicate, and then I will ask you if you guys can think of any others that we might consider. And so the first kind of communication can be through parent and offspring. And what kinds of things are offspring typically communicating to parents? Any examples? Yep. I'm hungry, yeah. And how do they communicate such a thing? Uh-huh. And what is it about the bird's mouth? Is there anything special about a bird's mouth?
Red color.
Red color, yep. So this is a sensory release. It's very salient is the word for the parent that will induce feeding behavior. Anything else? Yep. They're screaming, yep. So they're making a long-range auditory signal for the same reason in this case, yep. So often, I mean, right about this time of year, you may walk around and hear this sort of high-pitched, almost hissing sound of baby birds as they're calling to their parents, typically up high in a tree. You'll find the nest or in a hollow. Anything else that babies or juveniles are communicating to their parents? Yes, they certainly are competing with one another, trying to crane their neck and get higher so they get the food item. Yep. And what about parents? Are they communicating anything to their offspring? Yep. Right. Yep. So in a lot of fish, we have very subtle forms of communication, like a flick of the fin that makes all of the babies, the fry, suddenly drop to the substrate. This is something we're attempting to study, actually. I don't have a student on that. So a very interesting process because it's this hidden form of communication that it's not clear how the parent is actually signaling this this imminent danger or some reason to stay still and not move and be careful. Okay, so I think we just all talked about this. They use calls, that's the noise, beak gapes, they open up the mouth, and sometimes there's patterns within the mouth. And these act as what we call supernormal stimuli to induce feeding, not deeding, feeding from the parents. And supernormal stimuli are things that the sensory system is adapted to attend to notice, but it pushes it beyond the normal range of experience. And this is something we're going to talk about a lot more in the mate choice lecture next week. Okay, so then mate recognition is another very important aspect of communication. And this is very important because there's a bunch of processes that need to happen in order to mate successfully. First, you need to mate with the same species as you. Hybridization can occur, does occur. In the wild, but typically too much outbreeding results in fitness depression, and so the sterile mix between horses and donkeys, for instance, producing mules or asses are typically sterile. And so this is an example of when it's important to have mate recognition, and that can be achieved through a whole bunch of processes. So in courtship, males may have a variety of secondary sexual characteristics. So secondary sexual characteristics are things like ornaments, red, oh, well, not necessarily red, but coloration and perhaps calling. And it's secondary sexual characteristics because it's not the primary sexual characteristics, which are the genitalia, the things that are required to breed. Secondary sexual characteristics are not required for the act of breeding or mating, but may be involved in some other process like mate choice or recognition or assessment of the quality of a potential partner. Predator warning or detection is another nice example. And so here we have the different types of ungulates. Ungulates are animals with cloven hooves, hoofed animals. So deer, pigs, cows, most livestock are ungulates. And there's a behavior that they have called stotting. And what this behavior is a signal to the predator that that predator has been detected. Okay, and so this is a gemsbok, an antelope, will detect a predator on the savannah, and then it'll start bouncing with stiff legs, very, very conspicuous. So definitely the predator sees this behavior, and it's thought to be an indication that I already have seen you. So if you were to chase me, that chase would be unsuccessful. And so it's this way to communicate not only with inner species, but across species, even in this very hazardous context. Now, if you think back to last lecture about the prairie dogs, that's a similar context in which the individual has seen a predator, but it's not communicating to that predator, it's communicating to the other group members that there is a predator in that case. Okay, this is a very cool example, sort of the early sort of cool animal coloration that a lot of people get interested in, and it's aposematism or aposomatism. It's a process in which animals are very conspicuously colored. So it's the opposite of camouflage. Camouflage is a process where you're trying to not be seen. You're trying to blend in, which is very common, not to be detected. Things like chameleons are masters of camouflage. Aposematism is the opposite of that, where you're trying to stand out very, very strongly and be seen by the predator in order to tell that predator or that thing that would eat you that you are very dangerous or distasteful. Now, this is open to exploitation, which we'll get into from mimics. But let me just show you some of the very cool coloration that we can find in aposomatic animals. Yay, 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 yay. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so here we have your poison arrow frogs. I don't know if I'd agree with that. It's not Australian, for starters. And so these guys stand out in the rainforest very, very clearly, allowing all predators to detect them very early and not mistakenly consume them. It's not just restricted to, as you see, to poisonous animals and not restricted to frogs. Many types of animals are just distasteful. That spider example is a bit questionable, but anyway, it's a signal by which these animals are communicating quickly and strongly to be able to be recognized by the predator. Now, the predator, of course, needs to learn this this either specific pattern or the general process that if things are very, very colorful, they're likely to be dangerous. And that needs to happen because it doesn't help this single individual if it is eaten and in that process the predator learns, right? This is not how selection works. Selection operates at the level of the gene in the individual, not for the good of the species. And so many of these kind of patterns are generalized patterns that are common across different taxa. Okay, we already talked about olfactory signaling, but in this case, it was a form of territorial marking. And this is a way of communicating to conspecifics, typically, that is members of the same species, that this is your territory. You own this place, and you exist there, and you are likely to defend that area. Now, there's a couple of different ways that territorial displays can be achieved, and in fact, this is probably one of the more common kinds of animal communication that you come across as a human observer. First is olfactory marking, as you're seeing here with the glands at the base of this lemur. Also the urine-borne approaches. And the interesting aspect about this kind of communication is that it's long-lasting. So you only have to reapply these signals every few days or perhaps every week, and then any other individual coming into your territory will be able to smell these long-lasting signals and know that you are there or thereabouts. This helps over very large home ranges. Auditory communication, calls, bird song, these kind of things, deer calls, these are also relatively long range, but they have a very short temporal range. They only are there when they're being used. And so you may have wolves or these kind of things that make these calls that indicate in a general sense where the territory is or that this animal is there in that territory, but they don't persist over days. And then you have visual signals, for instance, by lizards, with the dewlap or the head bobbing behavior that maybe you've seen, which are immediate and need close contact. These are also very, very common kinds of signals. Okay, you may be also performing threat displays, and we're going to talk a bit more about this. We mentioned it in the cat, in which case you are baring your teeth and performing some other kind of visual or auditory signal to demonstrate that you are about to attack an incoming individual. You may display any kind of weaponry that you have or try to augment or accentuate your size. Okay. For signals to be effective, they need to be understood by the receiver. Yeah, especially in this previous case of agonistic or aggressive signaling, the point of that kind of behavior is often to avoid actual fights, because actual fights are dangerous for both the winner and the loser. It's very unusual that you would have a fight and that one individual would come out completely uninjured or modified in any way. And so a much better process is to settle the fight or settle the dispute before it occurs. And that can be achieved through a process of ritualization. And so it breaks down the aggressive display in this case, or any kind of display, into ritualized steps that represent the underlying message but are understood in a way by the sender and the receiver such that the overall process doesn't need to occur. And so if we think about how dogs or wolves or canids signal that they are being aggressive or being territorial, we can understand how it might have gone from a process of actual fighting to a process of ritualized display. And so the aspects of dogs interacting or canids interacting aggressively are very much shared. They bare the teeth, they open the mouth, perhaps signaling an incoming bite or attack. They open the eyes and they raise the ears. Okay, so they're dedicating all of their sensory equipment towards this individual, so it's clear that it's looking at you and focused on you. This display is directed at you. This aspect here is talking about the fact that this process here is linked to the actual behavior that's going to occur, just as I said. Of course, it needs to be perceived against the background of all the other things the animal is doing. We'll get to that in a few slides. And in fact, we already talked about all of these processes, so we don't need to. Now, importantly, if you've got some kind of very strong signal And this is an element that was first introduced by Darwin, like this aggressive behavior in which you've got the raised hair at the back, the tail up, the ears up, forward posture, growling. If you're trying to display the opposite to this signal, it may be important to separate those two signals as far apart as you possibly can. And this is called antithesis. So the antithesis of an aggressive display in a dog is this submissive posture, which basically reverses all of the elements from the aggressive display. Tail is down, head is up, showing the neck, hair is down, ears are back, mouth is closed. All of the elements of that aggressive display are reversed. And that allows very, very rapid identification on the part of the signaler and the receiver as to the meaning of this signal, which may help to settle these disputes before they become violent and aggressive. And so just before we take a break, oh no, we've got a bit more. Anyway, here's a video that I found of a dog attacking a stuffed toy, which I think is very appropriate. Oh, who's this idiot? Sorry. Okay, now just watch this dog here. It's coming up against the stuffed gorilla. And here we see the raised hackles, the eyes forward. The ears are not up because it's a Labrador, I suppose, and probably can't put its ears up very well. But all of the elements here are representing this aggressive posture, even though it's directed perhaps here at the wrong source. Okay, we'll just do this for a few more minutes before we have a little break. Okay, this is a very important aspect to this whole discussion. So pay attention. There is a difference between what is a signal and what is a cue. Now, a signal is a structural behavior that has evolved to manipulate the behavior of a receiver. Yeah, we discussed this change in the probability of a behavioral outcome based on the reception of the signal. So this thing, a signal, is for this purpose. It's adapted to change the behavior. It is under selection to be a signal. It's not there for any other reason. It's specifically evolved for that purpose. It is different from a cue, which is an aspect of the phenotype to which receivers may respond, but it has not evolved for that purpose. As an example, there is something about my voice that you are hearing right now that is a cue of some other aspect of me, but it probably hasn't evolved for that purpose. Think about the pitch of my voice and tell me what it tells you about me. Yeah. I'm a male, yes. Why? Okay, does everyone agree with that? Any alternative? I mean, you're right. It does probably indicate that I'm a male. But the question is the fact that my voice is deep, well, deeper, and that indicates that I'm a male, is that a signal or a cue? Is it important? Why do males have deeper voices than females of the same size? Yeah? Okay, and also males can hear it as well. Sure. Okay. Yeah. I would say that that aspect, male-female, is a signal. But this is where it gets interesting and some things are not very clear. But what does it also tell you, given that you now know that I'm a male, what else does it tell you about my physiology? What's in German the little guy that rides the horse in races? In English, it's called a jockey. Huh? Same word, jockey. Tell me about jockeys' voices. Has anyone heard a jockey speak? No one's heard a jockey speak. Okay, I should have put a video. They have very high-pitched voices because they are small. And so this is likely a cue, right? Because it's something that's informational that hasn't evolved to carry that information. To make it even more simple, let's take a step back. When you look at me, you see how large or small I am. That's a cue of my body size. It's a true representation of how big I am. It's information you can get about me that hasn't evolved in order to change your behavior. It's just something about me, like my skin color, right? My skin color is a representation or an evolutionary outcome of the climate in which my ancestors evolved, which just so happens is around about here in the world. Even though for generations I wasn't here, I was in a place where my skin color probably should have been dark, but it didn't have time to evolve. Point is, you're seeing something about me that has evolved for a different purpose, okay? That's the difference between a signal and a cue, and we'll give you some more examples so you understand this distinction after a 5-minute break. Okay, let's take a pause. Now that I'm sure you've been thinking about this difference between signals and cues for the last 5 minutes, let's talk about this. Is the vocal sac a signal or a cue? And when I say the vocal sac, I mean this inflating thing here. Is this a signal or a cue? What do we think? Yeah, Elena. Okay, good. So, Elena thinks this is an apparatus simply to push air through the vocal system and produce sound. Yeah, good. So, cue. Yeah, up the back. Okay. Okay, so you think it's a signal? Yeah, you vote signal. Okay, how many vote cue? 3, 4, you don't even vote cue, you just, okay, 5, 6, okay, signal? Okay, well, yeah, 7-ish, 8-ish, and the rest of the people are going to fail their exam. So, it's a good point, okay? It is needed, in this case, to push more air through the vocal system. It's like our lungs. Yeah? And so in that case, the fact that you're seeing this big thing has not evolved to change the behavior of another individual. It's just a byproduct. But also, some of these things are very colorful or ornamented, especially like the video I showed you. And so clearly possess some visual aspect to them. And so in this case, the vocal sac is both a cue and a signal. The visual components of it, in those species where it has evolved to be different, are now very likely to be a visual signal. But functionally, it's also a cue that is associated with signal production, in this case, the auditory signal. So in this case, we see both, but I think you now get the difference between this signal and cue process. Before we go on to this, can anyone give me any other examples of some aspect of animal behavior and tell me whether they're a signal or a cue? I'd like us to really nail this point. Tell me a cue. Give me an example of a cue. I'm producing sound. Yeah? But why am I, well, then I was accentuating it, but if I'm walking upstairs, what is that, a signal or a cue? It's a cue because it's a sort of incidental signal that I'm coming, but I may not want that to be, that's not why I'm doing it. But what if I do this? Then it's a signal, yeah? Because I'm doing that, in this case, so that you say to me, it's a signal, yeah? It's a behavior I'm producing to elicit a response in you. Yeah? Okay, now give me a cue, something that's really just a cue. Is anything really just a cue, or do you just not have any examples? Or do you think nothing is really a cue? Yep, I am not invisible, right? I cannot not be visible to you, right? If I was invisible, like if I was camouflaged in some way, this is, in a sense, trying to alter your behavior so you don't notice me, so you don't eat me. So that's, in some ways, a signal. But the fact that you see me now and that I see you is an inevitable consequence of the fact that you exist and you have a body, right? So this, your body is a cue that you exist. It's giving me information. What about if I walk in the woods and I see a foxhole? Signal or cue? Or a trail left by deer? So it's an incidental consequence of the fact the animal is doing something else, that there is evolution for the animal to walk and move and eat and feed and all these things. And just so happens that it also leaves trails in the forest to do that. I can see those trails in the forest and I know that there's an animal that's been there. And if I'm smart, maybe I know which animal it's been, or if it's left hair or something, maybe I can detect which species. But it's not evolved to signal to me that this animal is there, which is different to the olfactory territorial urination, right? Very different process that is actively trying to tell another individual, I am here and this is what I am. Maybe I'm a male or maybe I'm a female, whatever. Okay, good. Now let's move on to this question. Are signals honest? Anyway, sorry about that. And if so, why? Okay, so in this context, here we have this thing called a fiddler crab, and it waves a big claw. It waves these claws to other males and to females. And the bigger your claw is, the more attractive you are and the stronger you're supposed to be, right? But why don't you just grow a bigger claw? Why doesn't everyone grow a huge claw and wave all around? Yeah? And so that they have the biggest claw in the world. This gets to this question, are signals honest? Do they really reflect something about the underlying animal? And if they are honest, why? How could they be maintained as being honest if you could so easily cheat the system, right? So, for instance, if I was aposomatically colored, I was bright pink, so I was saying to the world, I'm poisonous, don't eat me, that might be useful to me, right? Or if you're some other animal, it might be more useful than a human. But so why not? And this is the question we're going to ask now. Well, the first answer to that question is that signals are not always honest. There is a benefit often to being deceitful in your signaling, and many signals and many systems manipulate that. So orchids are a great example. So orchids may mimic the chemical signals of female wasps and bees, and also the visual signals, so that male wasps and bees will visit these orchids, attempt to mate with those orchids, and thereby pollinate them. Yeah? So the orchid is signaling to the bee or the wasp, I am a female. It's actively, this trait has evolved to change the probability of a behavior in these males, but it's a lie. The signal is not honest. Unfortunately, or fortunately, or whatever, these males, this doesn't happen enough such that they develop an ability to discriminate amongst females and these flowers, or else it's just not very costly. Yeah, they lose sperm, they lose time, but yeah, you win some and you lose some. Batesian mimicry is a very interesting example. So whenever you have aposomatic coloration, typically it's associated with being toxic or being distasteful and the color. But then, isn't it better that you have the color but you don't waste energy producing the toxin? That would be a very good strategy. And it is a strategy that's played very commonly. It's called Batesian mimicry. And so here you have one system that really is typically poisonous or hazardous, and one that's copying the coloration and is not poisonous or hazardous. Can anyone think about that kind of system and when it would fail? What would be the process by which this would ultimately become a problem? Or is this just always a good idea? Yeah. And what would happen then? Yep. And then what would happen to the whole system? Yeah, the system would collapse because the predators would be eating toxic prey. They would be dying. The toxic prey would be dying. And the non-toxic prey would be dying. Everyone would be dying. Yeah? So it's not a good system. And so typically, this is an example of something we will get to, I can't think which lecture, called frequency-dependent selection. Frequency-dependent selection describes how many of the different strategies you can employ in the context, and that still be, well, it doesn't always say what'll be best, but it talks about the selection acting on the different strategies depending on how many of, or the frequency of that strategy. Okay, here we have a cyprinid fish in which the male has evolved this fin, which he will go up and put on the water surface and wiggle it so it looks like a fly has landed on the water surface. And the female will come up to eat that fly, at which point he'll mate with her and then go away. And so he's being completely deceitful in a different modality about what's going on in order to mate with the female. And then drongos, yeah, they do different bird calls. So the answer is signals are not always honest. And there's incredible benefit sometimes to being deceitful. So what does keep signals honest? Well, some of those signals can't easily be faked. And these are called index signals. And index signals are things like stripes on the body. So these things accentuate how big the animal is because they allow a very clear measurement of the, in this case, the black pigment against an otherwise lighter background. So we know this animal is this big, and it may accentuate it by growing longer fins. Also, the tiger stripes may be considered an index signal, may be considered. We don't really know because it's always hard to measure exactly how selection is acting on some of these traits, whether this is camouflage or an index signal. But the point is that these stripes can't possibly be longer than the animal actually is. So if there's something about showing how big you are, you can't show that you're bigger than you actually are. Of course, some animals grow appendages to accentuate how big they are. But if we're talking about these kind of signals, we refer to them as index signals. Similarly, you can't fake your weight. And so this is a series of experiments done with these spiders. And so the way these spiders interact is that you'll have spiders coming onto the web and they'll feel how heavy the other spider is. And when it's two males competing, they don't need to touch each other, they don't need to see each other, they don't need to do much except feel how heavy the other male is. And almost always it's the heavier male that will make the other male leave the web. But you can manipulate that by putting tiny little weights here. If you put a little weight on the back of the spider, and it's now heavier, it will win the competition because the other animal is using this signal or cue to assess how big this rival is and basing its decision based on that. And so you can manipulate the signals. But of course, in natural context, you can't be heavier than you actually are, right? So this is an index signal. It's a true representation that's forced to be honest by the limitations of your own body. And here is exactly what we talked about with the voice tone. In all frogs that were studied here and toads, as you get larger, the pitch of your of the call that the frogs make gets lower. So this could also be considered an honest signal, because even though I can put on a deeper voice, I can only go so low, whereas, you know, a huge guy could go lower than me. Or maybe a jockey can go higher, which could be of importance too. You never know. Okay, and then you have this idea called the handicap principle, which is supposedly enforces signal reliability. And so this is a concept that was introduced in the 70s by a fellow called Amot Zahavi. And it's an interesting body of theory that's very poorly supported empirically. Nevertheless, it's an important aspect of the discussion about animal behavior. And so the handicap principle goes that it's only animals that are actually really great that can afford to have big, flashy signals. Because if you have this big ornament, let's say, and the peacock's tail is, you know, the classic example, but you're still alive, it must mean that inherently you are pretty good at being a peacock. You can still find food, you can still avoid being eaten. And so the idea goes that if you're not very good and you grow this big signal, you won't be able to get away from, for instance, a fox, and you'll be dead. And so this signal, by being a handicap, is therefore honest, right? Because only those animals that are actually in good condition, have good genes, whatever it is, can have such a trait and survive. This is called the handicap principle, introduced in the 70s, very little support for it otherwise, because it's very difficult to demonstrate a survival cost with these empirically. That's one thing, but also people have been looking for support for the handicap principle for 50 years now, and the evidence is not too strong. Alternatively, you can have conditional signals or condition-dependent traits, and these can enforce honesty in a signal because they can only be displayed when the animal truly is in some kind of condition. It's different to the handicap principle, and I'll show you why. It's because they signal something about the phenotypic quality of the signaler rather than the genotypic quality or the genetic quality of the signaler. And typically these are resource-based traits, acquisition-based traits. You have to get something in order to show this signal, and therefore it shows how well you can get that something. And so here is an example of the red coloration. And so red coloration is often associated with these conditional traits because typically red coloration cannot be produced by animals. We cannot produce carotenoids or purines. They can only be acquired from the environment. So if you're very red, it means you've been able to go out into the environment and eat red fruits and seeds and whatever, and then use those carotenoids to lay down in your feathers or your skin, demonstrating that you are in good condition, in this case, in terms of collecting food. So these are conditional traits, which can only be displayed if you truly are in this good condition. They cannot be faked because they cannot be produced by the animal. This touches on another major aspect of the entire discussion about signal honesty, which is the question of whether signals are costly. So if signals were free, then all individuals should be signaling that they are in fabulous condition, that they have, you know, great hunting ability, that they're huge, that they've got whatever it is. Whatever the selection is operating on in terms of animal communication, if it's free to produce these signals, the pressure would be to cheat and to do so. So then the question comes, are signals costly in some way? And is that enforcing signal honesty? And in many cases, we do see that signals are costly in some way. And so here we're showing if you treat artificially males with juvenile hormone to make them grow these horns, you see other trade-offs in other aspects, in this case, the size of their eyes. And so here what we're seeing is that there's some trade-off in the signal you produce, whether it's energetic, ontogenetic, developmental costs, or if it's, for instance, in a display, like we saw earlier with the spiders, it's an immediate cost. That thing is costly because you're not looking for predators anymore, you're bringing attention to yourself. And so these costs may be so high that you cannot possibly fake these signals without paying for it in some other very dangerous way. And so here's this example again of predation and parasitism. So let's say it's beneficial for you if you're a cricket or a frog or these sage grouse to be calling a lot. Then of course you should increase your calling effort to some maximal rate, but that can vastly increase your predation risk. And so in crickets, they will likely be parasitized by these flies if they're calling. So it's only the males that attract these parasitic flies because they're the ones making sound. Obviously, if you're a frog calling, you're more likely to be detected by some kind of predator, similarly here, and of course here with the gecko. So these predation risks or parasitism risks can also enforce signal honesty because you're only able to call as much as is safe given these constraints. This I already mentioned about the bat detecting frogs. Interestingly, on this aspect, the bat detects the frogs not by the sound they're producing, but by the ripples on the water that they produce when they call. Yeah, they also listen for the sound, but they locate finally where the frog is by seeing, well, echolocating this ripple on the surface. Okay, secondarily, you might be metabolically limited or energetically limited in how much you can call. And so here, there's just a demonstration that the more calling you're doing, the more oxygen you're consuming, which is a representation of the energetic output of the call. And so there's only so much you can signal before you are exhausted. And this may be a way to enforce signal honesty. Maybe all individuals are signaling at the maximum rate that they are able to support due to energetic limitations. Similarly, when you're competing, so as we discussed in that first slide, or that first series of slides, not only are you calling in isolation, but you may be communicating, or it's not just calling, but communicating generally in a competitive context. And this is perhaps called the Lombard effect, or it is called the Lombard effect, but it may or may not be influencing signaling. And so here we have perhaps a baseline communication rate that is preferable for the animal, but then another animal is competing with that animal to produce a call. So then you have to elevate your call, and then the other animal has to elevate its call, and elevate and elevate and elevate until there's some maximum reached that they can no longer possibly produce a louder signal. And so this is another way that signal honesty can be enforced. The Lombard effect is also called the cocktail effect, and you'll notice it whenever you're in a lecture theatre like this or in any kind of room. If I say, okay, we're going to have a break now, then you'll start off speaking softly and quietly together, but then eventually you'll just have to raise until everyone is speaking quite loudly. This is called the Lombard effect. Not only do you have to compete in your signaling with auditory contexts, but you may be competing amongst all other communication modalities, and that can drive signal evolution to extremes that are on the edge of the sort of possible range. And you can think about this quite easily. If there's a population of fish, here we have guppies, and females prefer orange coloration, then a small spot of orange on one of the males, which are otherwise not colored, will make you the most attractive male in that population. It's an easy signal to produce because you only need a little of it. But then if all the other males also produce orange, now you have to produce more orange in order to be chosen, in order for the signal to be effective and the signal to stand out from the background. And so then all males end up having as much orange coloration as they can possibly have, as they can possibly gather, in order to stand out from the background. And this can also drive the evolution of large ornaments, of displays, of dances, and many other communication aspects. Okay, the final point we're going to make about animal communication is how it interacts with the signaling environment. And so this is some video that I took in Lake Tanganyika. This is our field site. And what you're seeing is, for some fish, it's quite obvious. They're quite clear in the image because they're brightly colored or they've got some beautiful ornamentation. But this interacts very much with where they are in the world. And so these fish are at about 5 meters depth, quite shallow, and so their colors are quite obvious. These fish have a bright orange eye, but they're at about 15 meters depth, and so you're very difficult to see that bright orange eye, although you do still see it in this image. Point is that if the environment changes, the efficacy or the value of that signal may also change. And so the same signal doesn't work in all contexts. Here we have some cichlids at about 20 meters in a place where basically all the red and the yellow light has been removed from the environment by the water. And so you're left with a very different color space in which to work. And so some of the signals will be ineffective. And here you're looking at that represented. So here we have shallow depths where the entire sunlight spectrum is represented. And as you go deeper in the water, you're left with only a smaller bandwidth of colors that are available to use in the visual environment. And so if you have this ornamentation pattern, at this depth, it'll be seen like this. And as you go down, it'll become almost invisible. And so this is an important aspect when considering all kinds of animal communication, that they have to interact well with the environment in which they're produced. And that can also influence, for instance, the receptor or the receiver physiology in the terms of the photopigments that they have. There's a guy, Julian Torres Daudel, who is also a researcher here at the university, who studies exactly this, does some very interesting work there. Okay, so just to give you a very, very blunt assessment of this, here you have blue and red cichlids, and this is how they would look. Cichlids are a kind of fish, and these are obviously just models, in full light spectrum, and they would appear like this. But then as you went deeper or went somewhere else in the lake, or in fact perhaps the water changed, as Lake Constance has, from being murky and cloudy during the 70s when there was a lot of agricultural runoff, to being very clear these days. But this is the reverse process that happened in Lake Victoria, where suddenly if they're under a different spectrum of light, you're getting a very, very different contrast between these two fish, such that they may not be able to be distinguished any further. And so this is the subject of a great study by Ola Seehausen, who's just over in Bern, looking at these Lake Victorian fish and looking at how the colors of the fish will change as you go down a depth gradient, and the types of signals they use will change as you change the environment, even though they're all trying to do the same thing. And so obviously, if there's a preference for red coloration by the female, it's better for all of these fish to be red. But it's no use producing this expensive red pigment if your light environment doesn't allow that red pigment to be seen. Now, if there's no red light coming down that would reflect off your red pigment, there's no point in producing those. And so just to go back to give you an example of this, if anyone's done any scuba diving and had the misfortune to cut yourself underwater, it's quite alarming because you bleed green. So if you look at the color of this guy's blood, it comes out and it's the red is completely washed out from the scene. And so this is a clear representation that any kind of red signal at these kind of depths is entirely useless. Okay, to wrap up. We have the animal communication environment and the signaler-receiver dynamics, which at its core is a very, very simple interaction. There's one animal doing something and it's directed towards another animal. But that communication, that signal or that cue interacts all throughout this system with others who you're competing with through things like the Lombard effect, to the female who's you're trying, or the receiver, sorry, not the female, but the receiver whose behavior you're trying to manipulate, who may have to have sensory systems that are different or adapted to detecting this signal. The environment as a whole may influence signal propagation, for instance, the light environment or the medium through which it's traveling. And those signals may be attenuated or changed by the fact that they're now vulnerable to eavesdropping or attack from any other individuals within the system that would look to exploit that communication. And we shall leave it at that. Thank you, guys.